My name's Mackenzie, and I started a GoFundMe for the adoptive mother of a nonverbal autistic child. The mother had lost her job because she wasn't able to find adequate care for this autistic child. So she really needed some help with living expenses, paying some back bills. So I launched a GoFundMe to help support them during this crisis. And we raised about $10,000 within just a couple of months. I think that the surprising thing was by telling a clear story and just like really being very clear about what we needed, we had some really generous donations from people who were really moved by the situation that this family was struggling with.
GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This podcast is supported by GoFundMe.
Yeah, no, we're not new. We're not young enough to do tickle talks.
Ew, that sounded real gross. Okay, a couple things for the intro. I just want to talk about everything. Apparently, have you ever heard of the saying "between the devil and the deep blue sea"?
It sounds like a song, but no.
You know what? It kind of does. We should make a song. It's kind of akin to "a rock and a hard place," but like nautical. So it's like, oh, it's just between a devil and a deep blue sea. Like, I don't know. It's kind of cool. But also, I had an article come up recently that said, it was a weather.com article, and according to Coast Guard Commander Dan D'Angelo listed the top three mistakes he sees boaters make. What's your guess without reading, unless you already read? I should have blacked it out, and I didn't.
You should have. I'm just going to pretend I didn't see it. With enough life jackets, not telling someone where you're going, and forgetting the drain plug.
Thanks for pretending. I appreciate it. Wow, you're so close. It's not filing a float plan, not carrying enough life jackets or flotation devices, and not having an emergency beacon. So, do you know what a float plan is?
Is it basically like a flight plan, but for boats? So like you just file a plan of like, this is my, you know, where I'm departing, where I'm headed towards, ETAs, things like that.
Oh my gosh, I didn't even know. Didn't even make that connection. Yeah. I was like, it's a float plan.
You know, it's like when you and the buddies, you know, fill up the inner tubes and head out and like you're talking like, hey, we're going to go hit, you know, Parcher Creek or something like that. Make sure you got them cold snacks. And that's a float plan, you know?
That's a good Friday afternoon. I planned to just float and chill. Yeah, that's what I thought. No, so like we grew up boating, but I didn't recall ever hearing the term float plan, float around or anything. But basically, yeah, like what you said, it's a document that you give someone back on shore. You don't give it to the Coast Guard, but if something happens and they give it to the Coast Guard, but with all the information you need in case you don't return by a certain time. So like it includes your vessel description, number of people on board, as well as medical needs, departure details like name, location of your launch ramp or something, your tow vehicle info, destination route, like all the stuff that you said, basically. It's like a pre-made missing person document that your trusted landlubber can give to the Coast Guard should you go missing.
You know, it's hard enough for someone to like alert someone that, hey, my friend's missing. So, you know, take out all the questions, all the issues like, hey, this is what they sent me. I don't know. I haven't seen Steve in 3 days. So I assume here's the list he made.
Poor Steve does not have good enough friends. They have to wait 3 days. Isn't the first 24 to 48 hours are the most crucial? Sorry, yeah. Steve. It can be a hassle, for small recreational day trips. Like I get that, but if you just like download a PDF online and if we find one, then we'll try to link it in our show notes and stuff. You guys can just, you know, copy it, but fill it out with like, I don't think your truck that's going to tow your boat is going to change every single trip. I don't think your boat's going to change every single trip, but just like, you know, keep like the generics just there.
And if they do, either one, please feel free. We have a donations page. Just let us, you know, under the waves, podcast.com. Just, you know, swing on by. We'd love to have a chat with you.
Exactly. Exactly. Help a good cause. But yeah, so especially like during the holiday seasons in the summer and stuff, more people out, more people boating irresponsibly because they only save it for this one weekend a year. More people probably having wrecks or something. So just, it wouldn't be a bad idea to have a float plan in place. Again, if we find a PDF or something, we'll link it in our show notes and episode description. And then there's also a thing called an electronic personal indicating radio beacon, or EPIRB, which E-perb. Is a small it's a small device that pings a signal up to a satellite and helps search and rescuers stay just that instead of becoming more search than rescue. That might be worth looking into for yourself or a boating friend you know. And then, yeah, having enough life jackets on board. And kind of speaking of wrecks, our thoughts go out to those who lost their lives and those who lost their loved ones in a recent boating accident on Lake Tahoe, the Mexican Navy ship crash, and the Fort Lauderdale, Florida boat explosion from a few months ago, the Harrison Lake, Montana accident, and any other that we might have missed. I think there was one off of California. I don't remember if it was this year or last year, but stuff that might have been able to be prevented. I think the Lake Tahoe one was a freak storm. And I think the Mexican Navy ship was like a malfunction of the engine or something. So some things obviously you cannot avoid totally, but if you can keep you and your loved ones safe, especially during the summer season, please do so. So, and to kind of end the intro, an interesting fact, there's also a great indicator for the next time you find yourself out in open water. If you start seeing white caps on the water where the waves are just kind of a little white on top, the wind is usually 15 to 20-ish knots. So that's 17.3 to 23 miles per hour, or 27.8 to 37 kilometers per hour, which can lead to smaller waves getting kicked up into bigger ones and small boats face swamping hazards. But just be aware of your surroundings, have a float plan in place and sent out, wear your life jackets and safety devices, or at least have enough on board for everybody, and keep an eye on the weather. And things can change in an instant, and we want you guys around for a long time. So
things can change in an instant.
Instant.
Say it again.
You're incensed.
I am.
Oh, well, you get to stick around and listen to that for longer. Who wouldn't want that?
Well, on that wonderful note of safety, security, positivity, and making sure you come back from your adventure, hello.
Ahoy.
And welcome to the Under the Waves podcast. It's a show about all things shipwrecks on the Great Lakes. My name's Andrew.
Oh, the suspense. And I'm Michelle, your captain for the day. Don't worry, we've got our float plan sent out, and we've been hoarding life jackets since the dawn of time, and we'll be passing out emergency beacons like the glow sticks on a summer night. Welcome aboard this week's episode.
I actually was canoeing a couple weeks back, me and the wife, and we came across a nice life jacket that was just floating on the water. There was no one in it either.
I hope there wasn't someone in it.
Yeah. Hey, that's a nice life jacket. Can I borrow that? But it was nice. No one. Yeah. There was no
Did
one
you
around.
Keep it?
I might have borrowed it. Yeah.
Oh.
Because there was like, I'm sorry. What was I supposed to do? It was
save it for the person who's waiting for it.
They didn't need it anymore. They're already gone.
It was Steve.
Yeah. And actually, since, you know, I'm trying to get out of this hole of borrowing this life jacket long term, but EPIRBs and things of that nature, like, you know, cell phones have a lot of, you know, cell phone coverage is really good these days. Mm-hmm. You can usually get away and, you know, get away with just using that and have cell, you know, coverage if you have an emergency. But having an EPIRB for when you're out of cell service, you know, something that's a beacon that's constantly transmitting your location, or something that like we have is a Garmin inReach for if we're ever out in the middle of the woods, you know, camping, doing whatever, have an emergency, or if we need to send a message to someone. Yeah, definitely look into it. If it's something you guys can swing, and you know, you might not ever need it, but I'd rather have it and never need it than really need it and not have it. So that's my little TED talk on that front.
Snaps all around. No, definitely. It's definitely same with the life jacket. Like, it's like, oh, this is uncool or not fun or doesn't look good. Like, it's covering up my cute suit or whatever. It's worth saving your life. There was something interesting because I was reading about the Tahoe wreck that happened a couple weeks ago. and it was a freak storm. Did you look into that?
Yeah, absolutely wild.
Oh, it's so crazy. It's like a beautiful sunny day, and then next thing you know, it's like snowing and all these like huge waves and stuff, and a lot of boats were crashing and things. And I think it was saying like, if you, even though the water is like super, super cold, if you're wearing a life jacket, it keeps you alive, I think, an hour or two longer for them to be able to find you.
Which that's nothing to sniff at. That's a long time.
No, yeah. It's a long time to be in the water, but it's a long time to like, if your chance of life is an hour or two extended for them to actually find you, because like Lake Tahoe is big, but it's also like they were within where they could have been found. Potentially, I think, from what I could see. And it's so sad that could have been, I'm not blaming the victims at all, by any means, but it's just like, it's kind of sombering to know that one little change could, you know, definitely change the result of your life.
You never know.
Yeah. So, congrats on your new life jacket.
Thanks.
Okay. Quick before we get into it. I know it's already been how many minutes, and we're just quick before we get into it. This is not the most fun story, especially when it gets down to, you know, the actual shipwreck and stuff.
It's not a feel good episode.
No, we're trying to like make it feel good. I don't know if we really did a great job of that in the beginning, but try to make it feel good we can. But it's not the most fun. So if you're not into all the like death and details, totally get it. Catch you in the next episode. We'll give a little warning before it gets really bad. It's just sad. It's not over. I mean, it's a little bit of gruesomeness, but it's just really sad. So just a heads up, if that's not really your jam, we get it. And we'll catch you next time. But for those of you who are sticking around, let's get into it. Sorry, Andrew, you're stuck here regardless.
No.
Put on that life jacket. Today we're bringing back the steamers with the SS Algoma, and I've missed steamers a bit. Have you?
I've really missed my triple expansion steam engines personally, but all across the board, kind of steam engines, I have missed them just a bit.
Fair. Yeah, sorry to disappoint again. The Algoma wasn't just any steamer. She was a screw steamer, and I think we mentioned it prior, but the SS prefix generally now means steamship, since there aren't many around, but when steamers were more prevalent, the SS could mean single screw or screw steamship, which is what the Algoma was. In callback, screw steamer or screw steamship are terms for a steamship that was powered by a steam engine and used one or more propellers, also known as screws. Now, let's move on from the word screw before we get a loose screw.
Or two.
Too many times. Thank you. The Algoma, official number 85766, was built in 1883 by the Aiken and Mansell Shipbuilding Company, which was a British shipyard located in Glasgow, Scotland. She was 270 feet long. Some sources say like 265. That is 82.3 meters. She had a beam of 38 feet or 12 meters and a depth of 23 feet or 7 meters. Her gross register tonnage was 1,750 tons, and she was powered by a compound steam engine that drove a single screw, having about 1,700 horsepower. And being the late 1800s, the Algoma was built with two masts, just in case one of her engines broke down, and she, along with two other ships, the Athabasca, which was launched on July 3, 1883, the Alberta, launched on July 12, 1883, were commissioned by the Canadian Pacific Railway Company. The Algoma herself was launched on July 31, 1883. The three ships were a type of ship called a Clydesdale steamer, not Clydesdale for you horse people out there. A Clydesdale steamer was a type of steel steam-powered ship. Wow, too many S's. Steel steam-powered ship that was specifically built on the River Clyde in Scotland and mainly used to transport passengers. There was a whole fleet of Clyde steamers that ran up and down the Clyde River, many operating from Glasgow downstream to various coastal towns, villages, and resorts.
And real quick, is it Glasgow or Glasgow?
You know what? I don't know.
I'm pretty sure it's Glasgow, but I have never been. So that's my excuse.
Let me look it up. I'm just a little American. That's embarrassing. Glasgow.
What, saying it wrong or being an American in today's age?
Both. I'd say arguably American is a little worse, but Glasgow. Okay. Sorry for saying Glasgow this whole time. I'm not going to
go. If back. You caught it, folks, ahead of time, give yourselves right a pat in. On the back, you know? Way it to go.
We'll send you a thumbs up.
In the mail.
I was going to email a thumbs up, but sure. We'll send you a mail. I don't want them to have my address. There was a whole fleet of Clyde steamers.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
...that ran up and down the Clyde River, many operating from Glasgow downstream to various coastal towns, villages, and resorts. Despite being Clyde steel steamers, the Athabasca, the Alberta, and the Algoma would spend their lives in the Great Lakes. This, in turn, made the sister ships some of the first steel-hulled vessels to traverse on the Great Lakes. Apparently, many early iron and steel vessels on the Great Lakes were built in British shipyards. For a time, Britain led the world in the development of these kinds of ships, and Great Lakes owners and companies were frequent customers for them. According to NPS.gov, quote, fleet orders from the lakes were not uncommon, particularly from Canada, for vessels constructed on the Clyde, end quote. Kelvinhaugh, a neighborhood in the city of Glasgow, was the leading producer of these iron and steel vessels, and some Scottish companies, especially later in the 1920s, specialized in the manufacturing of lake freighters or lakers. The Athabasca, the Alberta, and the Algoma were built identically and were intended for use as passenger vessels on the Great Lakes. And if you live in Canada, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think those are all Eastern Canadian towns, the names. So I know Alberta, but I think Athabasca and Algoma are also Eastern Canadian towns. I know I just said a very broad statement. I don't know where in Eastern Canada. Sorry. They were the first steamers purchased by the new railroad line. They would take the route of Owen Sound, Port Arthur on Lake Huron to Thunder Bay on Lake Superior. But first they had to get to the Great Lakes. The Algoma, along with her sister ships, set out from Glasgow on September 25, 1883, and it took them 13 days to cross the Atlantic Ocean and finally arrive in Montreal, Quebec. Unfortunately, the sailing was not smooth from here on out. Ships of the Algoma's size did not fit through the Welland Canal. They were too long. Apparently, this was a common problem faced by foreign shipbuilders and Great Lakes owners. There were two solutions to this issue. One, the ship was built in pieces, transported to the Great Lakes on other ships, and assembled once past the Welland Canal or any other part of the St. Lawrence Riverway that wouldn't fit said ship. Or two, the vessel was built fully prior to their trip across the ocean, but could be severed in two and carried through just the locks on other ships before being reassembled on the Great Lakes side.
There's got to be a better way. Like, I might...
ship in the Great Lakes.
Maybe.
What a novel idea.
Build a bigger canal? I mean, how frequently are we talking about...
Didn't that take years, though?
Like, don't worry about me. I'm just going to sever my ship in half.
Not one, not two, three. Three ships. And we just mentioned that the sister ships, including our girl Algoma, were self-powered over the Atlantic Ocean, so they had to be cut in half and transported through the Welland Canal. The ship halves were rejoined in Buffalo, New York, and there cabins were added, bringing the gross register tonnage up to 1,773 tons, as well as electric lights being installed.
We're so close to, like, 4th of July as of this recording. I really wish that it was three more years, because like, I don't know, I almost heard a bald eagle screech in the background, but I think it was just a little chicklet.
It's a cat I'm watching go.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's really close. That and the one of the ships, the Athabasca, was launched on the 3rd of July.
Yeah. We're close.
Just scooting around it. So close. Also, wouldn't you know, severing your ship and putting it back together just automatically have a decreased hull strength?
I mean,
they have
when
to be
it's
a
severed.
Part.
Yeah, it's significantly less resilient.
It's a big hole on both sides.
But I was thinking about that, of like, oh, let me just like test my new vessel going across the ocean. Awesome, it made it. Let me cut it in half real quick, and then let me just. You're gonna have to test it again. It is very interesting. As long as it was built in a way that they were like, oh, this is going to be taken apart. There's some sort of, you know, a latch or a clasp or, you know, put a belt around it or something. I don't know.
Snaps together.
Exactly. So I'm sure they planned ahead and they thought, but it.
Yeah. And it also sounds like they added more of the intricate details and stuff or extra add-ons after the fact. Like they added the cabins after.
The fit and finish.
Electrical stuff after.
Like, well said.
It was thanks. It was more of a bare bones ship, is what it seemed like.
Yeah.
So, man, I wish I could have found. If I can find a photo of a ship cut in half being transported, I will add that to the post. I did not find it initially, but I will look. I'll have a researcher look too.
Yeah, I'm sending you a picture right now. This is not what you asked for, but it's sort of what you asked for.
It's 11:11. I gotta take my phone off sleep mode. Ship happens. Should have named it that. Oh!
That was the Golden Ray car carrier that turned over and sunk in the channel in South Carolina a couple years back.
Oh my gosh. I was wondering why it was so gross.
And they
looking.
Cut it into pieces to remove it. You can see the cars in it.
Yeah. Ew.
We saw it when we were on one of our anniversary trips. Yeah. We were on an island or on a peninsula. We were on some piece of land near the channel going out to the ocean, and like we look over like oh look at that, and it was Jeez. Just there. I might have a picture of it on my phone.
It's a ballast level error was blamed for it capsizing. Did you see it all intact or just a piece of it?
Yeah, it was all intact on its side. We just like you saw the bottom of it.
So creepy. I hate it. The same time. Ugh. Did you? I should have done this as the intro. Have you seen the Netflix? I think it's a company called Trainwreck, but they do like one series, like one episode things that are like of different like accidents or things that tragedies have happened over time. They did one on the poop cruise, the Carnival cruise of 2013.
I have heard of that.
Oh, it's good. These people. I would not want to go through it. I get that would have sucked horrendously, but also like these people are way overreacting. It's so funny. Yeah, I'll try to find a photo. Love it. Okay. I'm going to carry on.
Sounds good.
This made the three ships more than likely some of the first, if not the first, electrified ships to be on the Great Lakes. Each ship cost was about $450,000 to build in total, and that's around $14.3 million today per ship. The completed ships could accommodate around 240 first-class passengers and 600 steerage passengers. Finally, after traversing the ocean, being cut in two, getting rebuilt and electrified on the other side, the Algoma was the first of the three to arrive at Owen Sound. She arrived on Saturday morning, May 10th, 1884, around 10 a.m. She was greeted by a large crowd. An old Markdale Standard newspaper article said about the momentous event, quote, by the time the magnificent palace steamship reached the railway dock, standing room was at a premium. The crowd was one of the largest ever seen in Owen Sound, and the Algoma was welcomed by blowing of whistles and ringing cheers. Flags were displayed from the town hall, custom house, elevator, and many private residences. So it was a whole party when she arrived.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like it.
That it's would be... kind of a... interesting looking ship.
Yeah.
A lot of fanfare. Which there's a photo we'll add that kind of has like a front diagonal. I think it's the first one in here. It makes it look a lot shorter than if you look at it straight from the side.
Yeah, it definitely looks like, a good bit different. It's a very traditional looking ship in a way too, though, but it's mm-hmm. unique in its own way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good. Well put. The Algoma took her first passenger-filled trip out the following morning, May 11th. She had on board over 1,100 passengers, with most of them reported to be emigrants from England, Scotland, and Sweden. And that's emigrants with an E. I didn't just mispronounce that. Her ports of call on this first voyage, where she would stop over to pick up and drop off passengers, included Cleveland, Detroit, Windsor, and Sarnia. There were some concerns with the new ships having a deep draft that could prevent them from entering a few of the lake harbors, and according to a May 24, 1884, Cleveland Herald article, the ships drew a little over 7 feet when light and around 12 feet when carrying 1,000 tons. But as far as we could tell, none of them had grounding incidents through their careers. A May 16, 1884 Thunder Bay Sentinel article described the Algoma entering harbor and, "Buckle up, it's a long quote." And this episode is riddled with quotes. Sorry. Quote, "The appearance of the vessel as she neared the dock was striking. Every available piece of bunting, which is colorful flags and decorations used on steamships for special occasions or as part of a naval tradition, was spread to the wind, and she rode in as stately as any ocean steamer ever entered harbor. The scene which presented itself upon the main deck can only be likened to the appearance of an ocean emigrant ship upon her arrival at an American seaport. Over 1,000 steerage passengers were crowding around the gangways ready to land as soon as an opportunity offered. Of the general excellence of the ship herself, too much cannot be said in her favor. She is certainly the finest boat that has ever sailed upon these great inland seas, and her superiority over all lake craft in particular is at once apparent. She has a crew of 25 all told. Captain Moore commands her, and her first and second mates are M.S. Hastings and R. McLeod, respectively. George Pettigrew is the chief engineer, and his assistant is A. McDermott. R. McKenzie is purser, and G. Taylor is steward," end quote. So she was a very fancy, very elegant, very extravagant ship that everyone definitely noticed when she came into harbor and seemed very excited to welcome.
And also some of these photos that you have, like there's one that's, you know, right here in front of me right now. And it's the, what looks like the dining hall on the, Athabasca. And yeah. It's beautiful. It's very fancy. Very fancy, very ornate.
Yeah.
Especially for a ship of that, like that era, I feel, or I don't know, just for being a lake steamer. I don't know, it's very beautiful.
Yeah. No, it's very, very fancy. They had like fine china and the folded napkins and chandeliers and all sorts of stuff, like real fine dining ware. You can imagine how like fancy and luxurious everything else was. And some of our pictures we'll include in the post are from like the Athabasca instead of the Algoma. But again, they were all identical. So sometimes there just weren't pictures of the interior of the Algoma, but there's some of the Athabasca and some of the Alberta. So we'll include what we can, but they're supposed to be identical. So just take it with a grain of salt. Over their working careers, the three sister ships would set time records for their regular runs. The Algoma, in particular, on her trip between Owen Sound and Thunder Bay, clocked the trip at an impressive 39 hours and 42 minutes. She then went on a journey from Toronto to Thunder Bay in an, quote, unprecedented short time of 47 hours, end quote. On May 16, 1884, the Algoma was the first of the new set of steamers to arrive at the Lakehead port in Thunder Bay. She had left Owen Sound at 3 a.m. on Sunday, arrived at the Sioux River that evening, and made it to Sault Ste. Marie by 9:30 p.m. While she encountered ice along the way, nothing could slow the speed demon of a steamship. The Algoma actually surpassed the steamer Nyack, N-Y-A-C-K, that had initially had a 17-mile head start. She then gained 4 more miles, all while carrying 250 tons of pig iron and 16 carloads of baggage. She was gloriously met with easily 800 to 1,000 people waiting on the wharves when she pulled into the Mark's dock at 8:30 a.m. Under both sail and steam, the Algoma could make about 15 miles an hour, which is 24.1 kilometers per hour, or 13 knots.
I mean, you gotta wonder how slow the Nyack was, like, just how fast, how much this thing blew past it. That is nuts.
I love it. So, I think it's right after, the next sentence, basically. People were kind of concerned about, oh, they're going too fast, and you're like, 15 miles an hour. It's just so funny. While all fun and games and very steamship-like, because there's a lot of steamship races out there, there were some rising concerns about the blatant disregard to safety and efforts to keep minimizing the three ships' times. This would prove unfortunately true for the Alberta when in July of 1884, she was involved in a collision with the steam barge John M. Osborne near Whitefish Point, but we'll cover that story in a later episode. All good times, safe or not, would come to an end for the Algoma on November 7, 1885. Backtrack a few days, so November 5th, the Algoma left the Owen Sound, headed on her usual route to Thunder Bay. The end of the 1885 season was looking to not be a great one for lake transportation in general. There was severe competition, low rates, and a small fox. Jeez. To attack the small fox.
You're really fixated on this fox. I mean, they're cute. Cute as a button.
Oh, gosh. And smallpox infringing on the profits of the season, causing it to be one of the worst seasons on the lakes in years. Due to this, several lines of steamers were actually laid up during the season, and the only company to report a decided improvement was the Canadian Pacific Company, along with their steel sisters, the Athabasca, the Alberta, and the Algoma. And to work on finishing up her season, the Algoma was loaded up with general merchandise, railway supplies, and the fewest passengers she had ever carried, which was 37 in total, although one source listed it as 7 cabin passengers and 6 steerage passengers. So there's anywhere from 11 to 37 passengers, and I think we end up finding out there's about 45 crew members. Teacher editing Michelle here. Yes, I know. 6 and 7 does not equal 11. It's 13. Just thought I'd let you guys know before you freaked out and wondered I can't do math. Thanks. This was more than likely due to how late in the season it was and the recent opening of a railway route around Lake Superior. And because we knew you wanted a breakdown of the actual supplies and merchandise, here you go. The whales. Oh my God. It's too late. I can't read. You have to carry on without me. The whales and the foxes take over.
Never seen one of those on the Great Lakes. Unless it's a whale back.
You'd be surprised. Callback. The wares, valued at $17,000, which is estimated at almost $570,000 today, included 195 tons of railroad rails, a car of machinery, a car of emigrant effects, which is luggage, furniture, travel to a new place and set up a home type of things, a car of apples, 4 cars of fish plates, 2 cars of cement, and 134 tons of general merchandise, which... my mind went to train cars, but I don't think she had a ramp to take on train cars, so I'm not 100% sure.
Maybe just like, I'm imagining maybe those like carts that, like an airport, you look out the window, you see all the luggage on those carts, or I don't know. Literally just me guessing. I have no idea. My question is, what are fish plates?
I don't know. I was hoping you knew.
4 cars of fish plates. I'm just like, is it, you know?
In welding. It's thinking about it. A fish plate is a metal or wooden plate used to join the ends of 2 rails or beams together, typically by bolting them to the sides of the joined components.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Splice bars or rail joint bars. I like fish plates better. Who knew? It reinforces connections and distributes stress. I need one of those. I thought that was funny. I'll tell my therapist about it tomorrow. The trip was going according to plan the first day, and the Algoma reached Lake Superior on November 6th. But about halfway across the lake, she ran into a heavy gale along with a blinding snowstorm. The Saginaw Courier Herald published a November 11th, 1885 article about the sinking of the Algoma. Spoiler alert. In it, they speculated that shortly after reaching Lake Superior, the wind began to pick up from the northwest, and a great wall of dark clouds along the northern horizon hinted at heavy weather. Realizing that the Algoma was claimed to be one of the strongest, most powerful steamers afloat, and definitely capable of handling even a severe storm, Captain John Steed Moore, age 33, from Sarnia, Lambton, Ontario, decided to maintain his course. Unfortunately for him, as the night approached, the wind continued to increase in violence, and by dark, one of the fiercest and most destructive gales ever experienced on the Upper Lakes had developed, and the Algoma was at the mercy of it all. The first mate ordered the sails to be set out to help stabilize the ship as she was rocking back and forth severely, but this caused her to drift leeward, which is downwind, and off course. The storm increased in intensity and quickly reached hurricane proportions. Visibility dropped so that the crew couldn't even see the length of the steamer. And according to a Port Arthur Sentinel article from November 13, 1885, the storm the Algoma encountered was, quote, beyond a doubt, one of the greatest hurricanes that have occurred during the last 5 years. The dreadful storms of February 3, 1881, but it's 1881-2-3. Which did so much damage, were exceeded in violence by the terrible tempest of the 6th and 7th, in the opinion of many old seamen, end quote. So, one of the worst storms I've seen in a while. Also, hurricane force on the Great Lakes was surprising to me.
Yeah, that's a spectacular storm.
Yeah. The passengers and crew were beyond terrified, and for a while half expected the Algoma to just plunge down to the bottom of the lake. Captain Moore ordered officers to circulate among the passengers, attempting to allay their fears, but they were all panic-stricken. One source said that, quote, the screams and prayers of the women and children could be heard above the thundering of the gale, end quote. Granted, I would be terrified on that ship as well. I don't think a little calm down would have helped me.
I would not be sleeping like a baby.
I would be crying like a baby. Around 3 a.m., a lookout was posted to sight the Passage Island light. The steamer maintained her full speed ahead, the 15 mile per hour, give or take the wind, until about 4 a.m.
Is it miles an hour or knots?
It was 15 miles an hour. I don't remember what that translated to knots.
Okay, 18. I just wanted to make sure. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. Until 4 a.m. on the morning of November 7th, Captain Moore ordered that the sails be lowered and their course changed. The engines were stopped and the sails lowered while the new course was set. The Isle Royals were sighted and the course was adjusted for Rock Harbor, where Captain Moore hoped to gain some form of shelter. And while the island forms a natural harbor that does protect against the elements, there is a rather dangerous reef near the entrance. At 4:40 a.m., less than 5 minutes after resuming steam power and the engine telegraph bell sounding to proceed ahead, the Algoma ran aground on the southeast shore of Mott Island off of Isle Royale, about a mile away from shore. Some sources say 50 feet from the shore, and from the pictures taken of the wreck, it looks to be somewhere between the two. We'll cover it a bit later in this episode, but it seems that the Algoma struck reef twice and drifted through the night toward the shore, so I think she started off like a mile away and then drifted in to be closer to 50 feet, but then some sources still say she's somewhere in between. So, take that with a grain of salt, too. There was a terrible shock to the steamer before she slammed to an abrupt stop. To an abrupt stop. Passengers and crew rushed out of their cabins to try and figure out what had happened. Captain Moore told the passengers that they were on a reef, but, quote, if you will only keep as calm as possible, I trust all will be safely landed, end quote. But just then, one of the crew reported that the Algoma's hull had been punctured and that she was quickly taking on water. The crew and passengers on board started hearing the crackling of timbers and felt the swaying of the vessel as waves started to beat up the poor, stuck Algoma. The passengers were also getting hit with driving snow and sleet in the relentless wind. One survivor would recall the scene as follows. Here comes a barrage of quotes. Quote, it is no use to describe the scene. Nothing worse ever occurred on Earth. In their madness, when the waves were washing over the deck, a number threw themselves into the foaming billows. Others, when a great wave would pass off the deck, which was swaying from side to side, were swept into the sea like feathers. A few hurried onto the ropes or to the masts, but the majority seemed to abandon themselves in the wild alarm and despair. Even the crew seemed powerless, so stricken were they with the awful suddenness and stupendous character of the disaster. Meanwhile, the boat rapidly went to pieces, end quote. The lifeboats were swiftly readied and filled as people were starting to get ready to leave the steamer. But just as they were about to lower the lifeboats, the steamer slipped off the reef and disappeared with a, quote, an angry roar, end quote, and any attempt to fully launch all the lifeboats failed. Another survivor, 52-year-old passenger William R. McCarter, recounted, quote, there was a frightful storm during the trip from Owen Sound until late Friday night when the passengers went to bed. The Algoma struck about 20 minutes to 5 o'clock Saturday morning, and the shock was a severe one, and the vessel trembled and shivered. I rushed out and saw three or four deckhands rushing aft and waving their hands like people demented. I followed the men and asked what was wrong. They replied that they did not know, but something terrible had happened. A stranger stopped me and said, quote, "This is a terrible occurrence. It is sad to think we must all die here. Let us hope it will turn out all right," end quote. This poor man was drowned in less than a quarter of an hour after. The end from down below, all crowded upon the upper deck and along the port side. The storm was terrible, the waves rushing in great mountains over the decks, and every few minutes the despairing shriek of some unfortunate persons was heard as they were carried out to sea and lost. The vessel lay broadside to the island, and there was a dreadful surf, an awful sea pounding and beating against her sides. The cabin soon gave way, and the women, children, and men were then washed off the boat beyond all hope of safety. A great many persons grew almost crazy and jumped into the sea in the hope of getting ashore. We did not know where we were at first, as it was quite dark, and it was a terrible storm of sleet and snow blowing in on us. The electric lights went out a few minutes after the boat struck, and the confusion and excitement were terrible, end quote. So basically, they hit a reef suddenly, thinking they were heading to shelter, and then the boat starts taking on water, everyone's going crazy, which, granted, that's very fair. It's a very fair reaction. The ship is rocking side to side. You're getting waves washing people off. It's dark. All the lights went out. And they don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, that's horrifying.
Almost.
And it's literally still winter.
Pretty dark out. Winter 4 a.m. is pretty dark outside.
Winter 8 a.m. is still pretty dark outside.
Yeah, that's
and
fair.
It's snowing, and yeah, that's
it's
just
snowing, sleeting.
That's a bad
crazy
time.
Waves. McCarter went on to describe the captain's bravery. Quote, "The captain alone remained cool and steady. He showed what a man he really was just then, and did his duty like a man. When it seemed a certain death to run a lifeline along the deck, he seized a rope and strung out the line, telling the excited people to hold on to the rope and not become panic-stricken. High rocks towered up in front of us, and a pitiless sea tried to snatch us in its icy clasp on every other side. In this manner, we passed the night until it was fairly daylight, the waves dashing over us every few seconds and bearing someone away from the life rope. I was standing between the captain and another man when the cabin came crashing down on the captain and pinned him to the deck. He cried out, quote, oh, I am done for now. What will become of these poor people, end quote. The man on the other side received a severe blow on his head and cried out, quote, I'm crushed, I'm gone, end quote. The next great wave carried him off without the slightest struggle, and he went to death without a groan. The night was terrible. No one can ever imagine what the people must have endured. Timbers were falling in every direction. The waves seemed to crush the boat like an eggshell, and every once in a while a falling stick would be followed by a deep groan, and we knew some brave man had given up the battle. I was dashed several times against the bulwarks and received this cut on my left eye and on top of my head, but in other respects I had a wonderful escape," end quote. Describing all this horror, and he's like, I had a wonderful escape because it could have been so much worse.
Yeah,
than a cut on his left eye.
Word wonderful, I wasn't sure what the next word was. I was like, I don't.
Yeah.
Wow, nothing about this is wonderful.
Well, it's interesting their choice of words because, like, oh, people were excited, but they don't mean like excited, happy. It's excited, like agitated, anxious, scared, like,
yeah.
Excited. And then the wonderful escape of, like, oh, it could have been so much worse. Like, for me, it was way better than it could have been. Like, it's so crazy. And then we have First Mate Mr. Hastings, who told the horrors of the night as well. Quote, the wind kept increasing in violence and was accompanied by snow and sleet. The sea was running mountains high and the boat was tossed about like a cork. When the ship was coming about with the changing of the sails, she struck Greenstone Point on Isle Royale, about 50 miles from Port Arthur and 1 mile from Passage Island Lighthouse, which had been abandoned since the first of the month. After striking the first time, the boat forged ahead, being driven by the wind. I think that's where they were talking about the first one, quoting of like how the boat suddenly lurched back into the lake. A second shock occurred shortly after the first. The vessel struck the reef violently, and she immediately commenced to break up. Most of the passengers and a number of the crew were in bed at the time, but were awakened by the shock, and the scene that followed beggar's description. Water poured in through the broken vessel and over the bulwarks, putting out the fires in the furnaces and extinguishing the electric lights. Screams of women and children were heard above the fury of the storm. The crew hurried hither and thither, doing what they could in the darkness to render assistance, but their efforts were of little avail, for in less than 20 minutes after the vessel struck, the entire forward part of the boat was carried away, together with her cargo and human freight. Several clung to the rigging in the lifeline the captain had stretched along the decks, but were soon swept away and swallowed up by the angry waves. The stern of the boat was steadily pushed upon the rocks, and those who were not too much exhausted with fatigue and benumbed by the cold crept to the after steerage and sought shelter. Less than an hour after striking, all was over, and but 15 out of 60 were saved, end quote. He also recalled that after the grounding, the first mate rushed to wake up the steward and some other employees as well as the steerage passengers. He found a female passenger and her daughter crying wildly in a saloon, clothed in only thin nightdresses. Hastings grabbed the lady's hand in one hand and the girl in the other and began making his way to safety when a great wave crashed through the cabin, catching and sweeping the woman and child out into the lake. He also remembered some men losing their minds and rushing into the lake while others climbed onto the Algoma's riggings. And as the waves battered the masts in and out of the water, the men struggled to hold on to their bearings. But after every wave, less and less people were holding onto the ropes. One man, quote, fought nobly for his life. He was washed off the boat and clung to some ropes. Slowly, inch by inch, he struggled along the ropes, hand over hand, back to the vessel. Every few seconds, a wave would hurl him around like a feather, dash him up, and then bury him under a mountain of ice-cold water. But he struggled on, until just a few feet from the boat, when his strength gave out, he passed away with a wild, wailing appeal for aid, end quote. This is the stuff of nightmares.
The Algoma it doesn't get much worse as far as like shipwrecks go.
No, it's so scary. The Algoma grounded in such a way that waves pummeled at her bow section, which caused the ship to break in two around 6 a.m., with her stern grounded on the reef, but her bow drifting off. During this terrifying time, many of the passengers and crew were swept away when the boat ripped apart. Quote, the water was covered with the struggling forms of men and women, and then all was over, end quote. Three people managed to make it to shore using makeshift life preservers, and the rest who ended up in the water were either swept away or smashed into the rocks. About 11 people, including Captain Moore, passed a tumultuous night on the stern of the torn-apart Algoma, which gradually drifted closer and closer to shore. Early the next morning, Sunday, the three men who made it to the island caught a lifeline that was thrown from those on board the ship and pulled the remaining survivors to shore. The island, which they found out was Isle Royale, had some fishermen who lived on it, and they saw the bedraggled crew of injured survivors and invited them into their houses, where they spent that day and the following night. Another account had the remaining 11 in a lifeboat fighting for their very lives. This story says that those in a lifeboat were powerless to save themselves as they had no oars, but Captain Moore was able to rip a footboard from the bottom of the raft and try to use it as a paddle. Expecting every moment to be their last, anyone on board the lifeboat tried either tying themselves to it or holding on with a vice grip to anything they could. Once the boat flipped over with the waves, and crew members were washed away before the boat could right itself. After the longest half an hour these people had probably ever encountered, the boat struck rocks and capsized again. However, to their surprise, they were only in a few feet of water and could make it up to drier land. Same ending with the fishermen finding them and taking care of them overnight. Regardless of the true tale, horrific as it was, the following day, the survivors were loaded up into a fishing tug and taken out to intercept the Athabasca on her trip to Thunder Bay. The Athabasca had left Owen Sound 2 days after the Algoma and missed the storm. After performing the rescue, she would take them on to Thunder Bay. The survivors, making 14 in total, included two passengers, 11 crewmen, and Captain Moore. 46 people died in the wreck of the Algoma, and it was figured that on this trip there were 11 passengers and 44 to 45 crew members on board at the time of the crash. A search party was sent to Isle Royale on November 10th to find any remaining passengers or crew, dead or alive. The party only found two bodies during that trip. More bodies and cargo would end up being located in the following months. And skip ahead 30 seconds if you don't want some gruesome details. The strength of the storm was so intense that of the remains of cargo and humans that were found were obliterated. Nearly all of the cargo was smashed to pieces and only portions of some bodies were found as the waves had, quote, dashed them to pieces against the rocks, end quote. Some hull sections of the Algoma were found completely flattened, and remember, this was a steel ship. Those who went back to the wreck site on November 10th found the aft portion of the Algoma, from the engines to her cylinders, with the exception of the upper cabins, lay about 40 feet from shore, which is 12.2 meters. Listing far over on its port side. No one attempted to climb on board the wreck due to the large swells still breaking over the ship, but the search party looked for anyone, again, dead or alive, that they could find, and they found three bodies that day, a passenger, the wheelsman, and one other unnamed person. The wreck of the Algoma is considered one of the worst losses of life in the history of Lake Superior shipping. Much of the stern of the ship was salvaged in 1886, the year after the wreck, while most of the bow was either salvaged or drifted away. The engine from the Algoma was used in the passenger steamer, the Manitoba, which launched in 1889. She was able to be used for 60 years on the Great Lakes before being decommissioned. Another salvage operation was carried out in 1903, but we're not sure the results from that. Many more first-hand accounts and media publications from the time can be found and read online. It's definitely worth a read. It is a hard read. We tried to include the ones that cover the most information, but if we read them all, we'd be here all night. And there's a lot of photos of the stern of the ship, and it looks eerily peaceful now after the storm, but I can't imagine the horrors of that night.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely wild. It's crazy that they actually got photos of it too.
Yeah, I feel like 1885 seemed really early for photos, but I don't remember facts like when cameras came out. Today, the Algoma's wreckage is widely scattered in 15 to 100 feet of water, which is 5 to 30 meters. Some portions of the stern are all that remain on the actual grounding site. The parts that are near shore are primarily spread out in three different fields about 100 feet apart for 30.5 meters. I just said 100 feet is 30 and 30.5 meters. You do the math. What can be seen in these areas are various pieces of the ship's equipment, including pieces of mast, pipes, valves, and davits. You can also see some passenger artifacts. Most of the wreckage is in relatively shallow water, and the lake currents and wave actions of Superior regularly rearrange what is and isn't visible. A few pieces of the Algoma have been located far offshore in deeper water, and these may be from the missing bow section. The Algoma is the least visited wreck in the Isle Royale National Park. Out of the 1,062 dives made to wrecks in the park in 2009, only 10 were to the Algoma. And it's just, there's not a lot of underwater photos, mainly because it's all just smashed apart. There's some really cool photos of the China that they had. You can just see the intricate details of it. But it's such a tragic story with kind of a unsettling ending of, I guess that's that. But yeah, it's definitely important to cover, and we'll cover her sister ship, the Alberta, some other time. I think the Athabasca ran until she got decommissioned. I don't think anything tragic happened to her, but it's crazy that they kept her engine in another ship running for another 60 years.
Yeah, no, that's incredible. I think something else that's really, like, it's really unfortunate, but also it could have been worse, because I think you said towards the beginning, like, there was a lot fewer people than a normal operation, you know, trip would have been. So it could have been much worse. Still incredibly tragic, but man, what a story. Yeah. What a shipwreck.
Yeah. Sorry, guys. It's don't always mean to be a downer, but it's
part of the history.
Yeah, part of the history is definitely important to remember, and definitely do some digging of your own. There's some really cool stuff, really cool old articles and recountings of it and stuff. It, like I said, it's a difficult read, not just because of the old English, but just because of everything that went down. You can just kind of hear that in the readings and stuff. It's kind of depressing, but it's also really cool to, like, remember that history, remember what people have gone through, and how far we've come with some shipping things and navigational aids. Like, oh my gosh, if they had a depth finder and GPS back then, they probably couldn't have avoided this. But also, or like even weather predictions. But it's just crazy how far we've come. And check out the cool pictures too. Yeah. It's very sombering.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for that. So Last week's trivia, we did not have any. And this week's trivia, it's not specific to the Great Lakes per se, but more of a nautical term. Did you know that the saying, quote, feeling blue, end quote, originates from sailing? How did this come to be? Or at least, what is your best guess as to how feeling blue came to be used as a saying still felt and used today? Skedaddle by here next week for more Great Lakes and Shipwreck adventures, stories, lore, and really almost anything at this point, it seems. Also, feel free to send us your own stories or inquiries at underthewayspodcast@gmail.com. Leave us those 5-star reviews and ratings on your favorite listening platform, and make sure to leave us a follow. While you're perusing the webs, check out our socials for pictures, things of that correlating to this week's episode. Instagram is at Under the Waves Podcast and Facebook Under the Waves Podcast. And as always, you'll have full access to our site that has all of our sources listed, and we'll have a few more cool things added to it soon for your viewing amusement. That's www.underthewayspodcast.com. So stay tuned for that.
And share this with the owner of a pet that just looks a little bit off. Now, it's no secret that I watch pets professionally as one of my gigs, and I'm currently finishing up a house-sitting gig halfway through. The owners are lovely, the house is beautiful, and the pets are fun, but they're just a little bit more on the quirky side. The dog has the most incredible blue eyes, but acts like she can see other worlds peeking around the corner. It's extra unnerving the way she looks up at the ceiling as if watching something skitter across the fan. And then we have the cat. He's sweet and fluffy, really only wanting to be pet when it's feeding time, but he's built like his skin doesn't quite fit. His neck is too long, his head is too small, his back is too weirdly arched while walking, but not in a something's wrong way, just like he was assembled a bit wonky. He almost has an air about him that gives off he knows more than he lets on, and he's only pretending to be a cat to live the good life. I've also watched dogs that mirror the one Hunger Games book where their eyes are just a little too human, if you know what I mean. Or maybe you're like me and have a fish-eating monster snail taking over your aquarium. Whatever the case may be, share this episode with that one pet parent who's just trying to get through the night no matter what is staring at them from across the room or even on top of their bed.
I'll be honest, when you started that whole monologue there, I wasn't sure if you were talking about the pet or the owner being a little bit off-looking, and I was a little concerned. We're talking about the pets, okay.
Oh, that's something we don't name on this podcast.
Yes. And real quick, before we sign off, we wanted to share something regarding the day this episode is releasing on, the 4th of July, 2025. Often this day is wrapped up in fireworks, flags, and talks of freedom, but for many, this is a complicated and even painful day. The loud explosions can trigger PTSD for veterans, trauma survivors, and not to mention all the animals, pets, and critters who have no idea what is going on and why there's bombs going off everywhere. The promise of independence feels rather empty to those whose rights are still under attack, which include, but are not limited to, victims affected by ICE, marginalized communities, and anyone watching hard-fought freedoms being stripped away day by day. For others, this is a day tangled up in family tensions and political arguments that feel impossible to navigate through. We just wanted to let you know that it's okay to feel those things. It's okay to skip the celebrations, to take a day of self-care, rest, and a day of quiet as much as possible with everything else going on. It's also okay to enjoy the fireworks or the cookout simply for what they are without attaching any deeper meaning. And it's okay to feel pride for how far your country has come and still realize that it's not okay for us to take so many steps back. We are not a free country until everyone is rightfully free. Independence affects everyone, and until we have a seat at the table for everyone, Independence Day is not truly Independence Day. Take the time and the day you need, and we're here supporting you. And in case no one has told you yet today or this week, we love you and thank you for being here with us. You matter.
Thank you.
We release new episode.
Take the compliment.
We release new episodes every Friday. And until then, folks, fair winds and following seas.
We'll catch you next time under the waves. Bye.
Cheers.
It is quieter under the waves. Also, what a roller coaster.